The Solid Foundations Property Podcast is brought to you in association with Gap Property Investments, helping you getting a better return on your money in 2026 through property. Check out gappropertyinvestments.com. And also CitySTAYS, Ireland's leading provider of customized accommodation solutions, specifically designed for contractor teams working on projects. Check out citystays.ie.
You're very welcome to another episode of the Solid Foundations Property Podcast. For once, it's actually me introducing the podcast, Lisa O'Reilly here. We do have Porik online, but unfortunately, his Wi-Fi doesn't seem to be working very well today. He's away traveling, so the joys of it. So we're just rolling with this one. So today we have a very special guest on the show. This is our third podcast of 2026, and I think this one's going to be pretty special. So I'm going to introduce you to Christina. And Christina, if you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into property, that would be great.
Ah, thank you. Hi, my name is Christina Castellina, and I've been in property now for 12 years, which makes me feel really old. In terms of property, I've had quite a a varied career in property. I started without any funds, like a lot of people. There's that close-up again. I've just seen. So when I started, I was in my late 20s. I was a full-time singer, pretty happy-go-lucky, but really did want some stability. Always, you know, look to the future and kind of, I always, even as a child, would wonder like what people did and how they earned their money and how they earned so much money. I always had like an interest in just being quite open-minded to what people did and how they did it. And then when I got to my mid-20s, I started to think, actually, like, as much as I love singing, I was ticking off all the things I wanted to do. And just really craved stability and wanted life on my terms, because as a singer, when you're in shows, you literally, your life goes on hold. You turn up to an audition. If you get the job, sometimes you start in 2 weeks, you pack your bag and off you go. And I wanted to take back control, really, but definitely didn't want a job, had no A-levels. And I'd only ever wanted to sing and perform. So anyway, long story short, like a lot of people, I invested in property training. I spent my life savings on property training. It was quite expensive, and just jumped into property. And because I had no money, I had to get really good at raising finance. It was the skill I had to master if I wanted to progress at all. Like, even to buy my first property, I had to learn the skill of raising finance. So that really, I would say, was my two main focuses have always been finding really good deals that stack and raising finance, and then outsourcing everything else to good people so that it frees me up to be able to continue to do that. And that's basically what I've done for 12 years. So I've purchased over 50 properties, various different strategies, from your basic buy-to-lets to serviced accommodation. I own some blocks of serviced accommodation. I own a big property called Empress Hall, which is a big detached 10-bedroom property, 4 stories, sleeps 20 guests. It's an experience. It's like a real fun, crazy, amazing house that's quirky, mad decor, a cinema room, a games room, Xbox room, Love Island style garden. It's amazing. And then loads of flips, particularly over the last few years, I've been doing flips just for something different, something fun, you know, to kind of, which is quite nice. I mean, who doesn't want to just get lump sums of money? And still using that focus of raising money to do deals. So that would be the quick kind of version of what I've done, I think. Oh, I've done HMOs as well. I always forget about that. I did do HMOs, but I sold them all because it wasn't for me.
Okay, so let's go back then to some of the, let's pick back through some of the stuff that you've done. So did you start off raising money in order to buy and do buy-to-lets? And then did you move into HMOs and then serviced accommodation? How did you get all started? Was it just a straight off buy property?
No, I did it all the wrong way around. So I was doing director vendor marketing, and I had a landlord come to me who was retiring, and he had a house that had been converted into 5 studio apartments and a 6-bed HMO, and it was with DSS tenants, and they were really run down. They were really depressing, to be honest. But I negotiated the price so well, so discounted. They were like £79,000 each. He wanted 140 to begin with. And I negotiated them down so cheap that I kind of needed to buy them, but obviously I didn't have any money. So I, by chance, really met someone at a property networking gala in London, and we JV'd. So we did those two together. So he basically financed everything, and I did all the donkey work, so to speak.
Hey.
Yeah, we did five, maybe six deals together, back to back to back. So obviously that HMO was purchased already, all on. Well, I'm trying to think, were they on suites? Had kitchenettes, and maybe some of them were on suites. But from that, we then started turning properties into HMOs, and we were going 6-bed, 5 en-suite. So big. I jumped into big renos, and everyone said to me, start with buy-to-lets, don't do HMO straight away. But I think because the first deal I did was a HMO, and also because it was with a JV partner, there wasn't enough profit in doing buy-to-let. And also at the time that this was, let me think, 2015, maybe 2014, 2015, something like that. At that time, in my area, there were lots of big houses that no one wanted to buy that I could pick up for 80 grand.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't do that now. It would be, yeah, they just don't seem to be for sale. Like, it's just, but at the time, there was a lot of them being repossessed. They were just these big terraced houses that people didn't know what to do with, and they wouldn't really have lent themselves as buy-to-lets. So there was a mixture of reasons why I jumped into the HMOs. But the problem is, we were just doing one after another without really testing the market. And it wasn't a great place for HMOs. There wasn't huge demand. The tenant type was very transient. Actually, the house that was the most stable was the DSS house, believe it or not, because we already knew they were on benefits. They didn't have a job to lose. They were just like there and quite happy to stay there for years. And actually, it was fine. There'd be an occasional kickoff, but really it was fine. The other properties, which we actually made a lot nicer and we spent a lot more money on, and we were aiming them at professionals, we were just having all sorts of turnover and people coming, getting, having a job, losing the job, now on benefits, and a constant mix then of tenants. And it
It doesn't
just.
work, does it, when you have a mix of tenants in a house? So we do the same. We've probably got a similar story, Christina. So I didn't start I only started about maybe 5 years ago, but went straight into HMOs, buying HMOs, raising finance for them. Because I think a lot of people, when they start out in property, and especially if they go to the property training, they advise you to start with like kind of rent to rents to test the market. And I just went, no, I'm just going to raise money and I'm going to, do HMOs from day one. But really, like, probably should have, like, it's good advice,
Yeah, it's good advice.
days or rent to rents or rent to HMOs, because you get to really kind of learn the market on someone else's kind of property, but yeah, no, I started similar to you, and I just went down the HMO route, and I kept on just doing it back to back without really thinking. But luckily for me, I was in a university town. I was in a hospital, kind of a university hospital town as well, so, or a city. So it did lend itself to people coming and going. But yeah, like that, the HMOs, they are a bit of extra work. Now, you said that you've got into serviced accommodation, but you got out of HMOs because they were too much work. But for me, serviced accommodation is way more work than
It is.
HMOs. How comes? What's your opinion on that, and why did you go into serviced accommodation?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. It's way more work. But the difference with, so when I first started and I went into HMOs, I was having to split the income, but I was having to deal with all the stress.
Okay.
And I'm sure there was stress for him, but really the day-to-day, it was me taking the calls, it was me meeting the builders, and it was a massive shock from being a singer to that was a massive, it was really negative as well. It was just a really negative business. The letting agent didn't really want to manage them. She was very negative. And yeah, it was just too much of a shock for me. And I just didn't like it. So where the SA stuff comes in is, when I started doing SA, I'd already built a really good portfolio of buy-to-let. So all of my basic needs were already covered. I think I'd, at that point, got maybe 15, 16 buy-to-lets. So I had a really stable footing, which is what I really wanted. And then the SA stuff was more to, I was like, obviously I wanted them to make money, but I wanted to play and experiment. And I don't manage anything myself. I outsource it. And to begin with, we had a managing agent who was dreadful. And actually, I remember at one point we were chasing them for the money because they weren't paying us the rent. Like, I think they were maybe, I don't know. I don't know if they were like living off the rents. I don't know, but it was stressful. Then we changed to a more local agent. They were also dreadful. And then you still have to kiss a few frogs. And then eventually, we got the managing agent we're with now, and they are exceptional, and they deal with pretty much all of the day-to-day, and I only get involved with the high level decision making. I don't really get involved, so that's where, so at that point I had Highcliff, which is a block of six, and I had another couple. And then I didn't do Empress Hall, which is a real big beast to manage. I didn't do that until I had that really good managing agent and I felt confident.
Comfortable.
So it is more, but essentially I don't really do much of that. And I also have an on-site manager. So at the back of Empress Hall, we have a flat and I have an on-site manager that lives on site. So it's really well managed. There's not a huge amount for me to do. I just go around and look at, make sure the decor's okay and do a few spot checks on the cleaners and, you know, but really it's not.
It's not much hands-on management.
More of a mental tab that's opening my brain, especially this time of year with SA, like, oh, winter. And then in summer, you know, you make loads of money. And then, I do feel like there is definitely more stress with serviced accommodation in that no year is the same. And you can't just sit back. You can't just sit back and chill and expect year after year after year for you to have endless bookings, because it's very forward facing to the economy. And so however the economy is feeling, I think if you're in hospitality, it's felt in hospitality.
Very good. So Christina, you're very good at raising money, doing joint ventures. So some of our listeners, they're looking to get into property and they just have this mental block in their head that I don't have money, so therefore I can't invest in property. And we both know that that's not the case. And you indeed, you can invest in property. You don't necessarily need the banks to begin with. It's all about kind of, there's people out there with money who want to invest with the likes of me and you, who are willing to do the work to get the properties up and running. So can you just kind of explain, I think you said the first one was like a joint venture, so like you went to a networking event, like how do you approach those conversations, and then how did you ever just do private loans, or was it all joint ventures? And just give us a little bit extra about how you raise money and what's your technique.
So when I first started, it was so I've only ever done one joint venture, like one partnership. It was with the same person and we did five or six deals, and then since then it's been purely angel investor. So they lend me money, I do a deal, I give it back, and it's all in my name. So I've done both. In terms of the strategy, the first strategy was to go to a networking thing and get drunk.
And I love your honesty. That sounds like my kind of networking event.
I got really drunk. I was really overexcited to be there, to be honest. It was in London at a really posh hotel, and usually I'd be singing on a Saturday night. So I was just made up to be in London. And I had these business cards with my name, with a picture of my face so people could remember. And I think I might have put Blackpool, because that's where I was living at the time. And I was going around talking to people because it was specifically a property networking event. So, and at these things, you know, there are going to be people that are actually looking for partners. And he was looking for a partner. Like he'd gone there knowing he had bags of cash, but he didn't want to find deals. He didn't want to do any of that. So he was looking for me. Yeah. And I happened to be looking for anyone with money, really. I don't really know what I was doing. I was just making contacts and chatting and saying, I'm from Blackpool, I'm finding all of these deals. And then he was like, that sounds so interesting. And I was like, I'll give you my card. Then he phoned me the next day and I was like, oh gosh, what have I said? And he said, you know, you've said you've got deals. And I said, I do. And they said, can you send them over? And so I put together the worst proposal you've ever seen in your life. It's honestly horrendous. A child could have done better. It was all because I really like color. I'd done the text all multicolored font, all different colors. It was the least corporate thing you've ever seen. Luckily, he's as a lot of successful people are, he actually quite liked that. He's quite what's the word I'm looking for when people are quite
they don't go with the status quo. They're kind of a bit
eccentric. That kind
eccentric.
Of,
yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he just quite liked the madness, really, and
the multicolors.
They're multicolored, and just the truthfulness of like me actually just this is who I am. The one thing I did well is I knew my numbers really well. I presented the numbers, the rents, the done up value. I did make the mistake of thinking every property only needed a 10 grand refurb. Genuinely, yeah. Any house I viewed, 10 grand, had absolutely no idea. But I sent proposals over, and the same evening he was like, these are absolutely fantastic. He was based in the Midlands, and the prices where he lived in an affluent area were like triple, nowhere near, you know, the kind of value for money that I was finding. And he said, yeah, let's do it. And that was the start. So that's the JV stuff. Once he said yes, that was a rolling.
Yeah.
You know, he just said yes to everything, really. But then the private investor stuff, kind of similar, the same terrible proposal, but I would change it to every deal that I found, put the figures in, and then I would also use my experience that I've had on the previous deal. I would put that. I also would put that the education I'd done, the mentorship that I'd done. I would lean on their expertise as well and say my mentor is so and so, and I still am in contact, and you know, I ask questions, blah, blah, blah. So it's building a picture that you are someone that A, knows your stuff, is taking it seriously, has support around you, but then also being able to demonstrate, you know, this is a good deal and this is why, and here are the comparables to back those figures up. And so when I started buying for myself, it was really small deals. Like the first thing was a £35,000 flat. And I remember the investor that lent on that was actually a really seasoned investor. And he just had funds in his account he wasn't using. And he was like, I'll lend you the 35. I just want a first charge. Can you get it done in eight to 9 months? Because I'm going to need it back for something else. And I was like, yep, let's do it.
And did you find that investor, Christina, from that same property networking event that you went to? Or did you do it via social media? Or what way did you find him?
So he was, he had done the same training as me.
Okay.
Yeah, so I met him kind of just through general networking rather than, I didn't know him that well, if I'm honest. In fact, I would say the majority of my investors I don't know that well. This is also before the likes of Instagram.
Okay.
Yeah, there was no Instagram. It was Facebook. See, I do sound old, don't I? And with Facebook, I did use Facebook a lot. So I used Facebook to share my journey and my progress and the excitement and found a deal. And then I would literally put found a deal, looking to raise finance, send me a DM. And then people would inbox me. This is kind of how it grew from that one. People would inbox me and then I would send them a proposal. And then you know, often people would ghost you, but then there would always be one or two that would come through and say, yeah, this sounds great. And that, so the first guy that lent the 35 never lent to me again. It was a one-off. But the investors that came after him, most of them have stayed with me.
Going.
Yeah, they
keep going. So when you say stayed, keep going, Christina, you mean you use their money, they get first charge on the property, they lend you the money, you buy, you do the refurb, you get tenants in them or guests, whether you're doing a HMO, a serviced accommodation or a buy to let, and then you go to the banks and you get refinance. And so what you're hoping for is that the refurb that you've put into the house, and also the deal that you've done with the vendor in the very first place, you're hoping that you've now added value. So then when you go to the banks to get your refinance at your 70 or 75% loan to value, that full amount of money should be able to repay that angel investor back. Is that how you're trying to operate?
Exactly that. That is exactly it. And that is what I did. One after another, after another, after another. And I just stayed in my lane. I didn't get sidetracked because everyone around me was doing conversions, commercial to resi, new builds, big, massive 30-bed HMOs. And luckily, I'm actually really lucky in a way that I did the HMOs first to feel the sting of it, to retreat back to going, actually, I need stability and to build that stable base. And to actually, because I think when you start, I used to just look at spreadsheets and go, well, that's going to make me £1,000 a month. And I had no concept of the reality of business and no concept that, yes, a spreadsheet can say one thing, but actually there's voids. There's voids, there's maintenance, and there's things that you never really understand until you're in it and you have that business. And then you're like, oh, this isn't the what I thought it would be. So yeah, I just stayed in my lane and collected these little grunters, these cheap little houses that worked so well. And they did, they're just little dream boats. They don't give me a spot of bother. Touch wood, generally they don't give me a spot of bother. And just built my investor list that way. And alongside that, because I do think that in property, especially now, it's really important to have other income streams. And the reason why is because, you know, when I started, you could do money in, money out much easier because there wasn't 5% stamp duty. And that difference of that 5% is the difference between a deal being money in, money out, or a deal that you leave £5,000-£6,000 in, just on that alone. And refurb costs were cheaper and legal fees were cheaper. You know, there were... I just think it was a different climate, and you can still have great success now. So I'm not knocking, you know, you can still go and have incredible success right now. But I do think that there needs to be, and the more money you can create and earn, the easier property is, because then the way that I sort of built and scaled so well is I understood that not every deal would be money in, money out, despite how right, sometimes you get a down value, sometimes the refurb goes over, that's the way it is. So I was really fortunate, actually, that I got picked up as a speaker, and I worked for Rich Dad Poor Dad.
And
yeah, it was amazing. And Martin Roberts, it was all really the same umbrella brand. And I spoke all over the UK and abroad. It was such an incredible experience. And it's before I had kids, so I could just do that. I had no commitments. And it was really well paid. So I was really, really strict with myself. And I didn't touch my property income. And I would try to not spend all of my speaking income. And I would basically invest my speaking income. I would go, well, that £3,000 is going to be left in that deal. And also would also source the odd deal as well. So I always had little pots that would come in that I would leave in deals if I needed to. And it was, I would literally create a spreadsheet of all the deals and I'd be like, right, where's that coming from? And I'd allocate funds. And that's really, I think, the way, because I think some people buy and they're leaving angel funds in without any form of plan. And I know accidents can happen and I totally get that. But I think there needs to be a realization, really, that
The Solid Foundations Property Podcast is brought to you in association with Gap Property Investments, helping you getting a better return on your money in 2026 through property. Check out gappropertyinvestments.com. And also Cities Days, Ireland's leading provider of customised accommodation solutions, specifically designed for contractor teams working on projects. Check out citystays.ie.
Yeah, additional income really helps.
Is needed. Yeah, that's exactly what happened with me, Christina. So I went to I'm in Ireland, Southern Ireland, and I was investing. My golden area is in south of Ireland called Waterford, and the yields are very, very strong because the rental income is very strong, but the capital appreciation is not great. Mm-hmm. There is a limit. There is a ceiling. So I was going over to the UK, learning all this. That is, you know, as you just said, money in, money out, which means that you're hoping that the value that you add when you get your 65, 70, 75% loan to value mortgage at the end will more than cover the angel investor so that you don't leave any money in the deal. But my reality was, and that was what I was expecting, but my reality was that wasn't the case. I wasn't able to get that increased in valuation, mainly being because I started with HMOs. And number one, over here, the banks were only lending up to 70% loan to value. A lot of them were only lending 65. And also in terms of that valuation at the end. So whilst I was turning a 4-bed house into a 5-bed HMO, I wasn't getting a commercial HMO valuation on that house. And like you, I didn't go for planning permission. So I was using within the existing footprint of the house. So any evaluator that would come out, they would still say, okay, it's 5-bedroom or whatever, but still it's in that area. And mm-hmm. there is a ceiling on that price. So my reality was I wasn't getting that uplift in that capital value. And there was a couple of times where I had to find the money, you know, and as you said, you have to kind of look all around you where to get the money from. So my number one was when I was using my investors was they had to be paid back in full. I had to be the one to be at a loss because my credibility, my whole reputation, Ireland is a small place as well, it revolves around me doing what I would say I was going to do, which is to repay my investors back. So whilst I said to my investors, I'll get this much of an uplift and then I'll be able to refinance and get you, that piece didn't end up being true because I didn't get the valuation. But what was true was I ended up paying back their full amount of money. So what that meant was I had to use the income from the house, because it took about maybe nearly 8 months to get refinanced over here, maybe even a year. So the whole year of kind of getting that income from a HMO, I, as you said, put it into a pot and then use that money then to pay back my investors. So I wasn't for the first kind of maybe 1 or 2 years, I wasn't getting any income really from the houses. It was, yes, I was growing my portfolio, but it was like I was reinvesting it all mm-hmm. back into the house. But look, I like yourself, I went down the HMO route to begin with, and I realized that yes, that is like the most amount of yield for us. That would be the most amount of yield at the time. But then I found this serviced accommodation business for contractors. So we went heavily down the route of serviced accommodation for contractors. Very not passive one little bit, but it is it is high income. But yeah, no, it's interesting to see how you you know, you went down the route of HMO, you realized that it wasn't for you and you stuck with the buy-to-lets. So Christina, in your area, say, back when you first started doing this, 2015, 16, that sort of time, what was your typical purchase price, refurb, and then refinance? And was you pulling out much out of it, or what way did it work?
Yeah, so on the buy-to-lets, typically I'd pick them up for 50, no stamp. You know, and also I was doing a lot of buffer fluffs where I could do a refurb for 10 grand because the kitchen would be fine, but I'd just do the bathroom and decor throughout. I've done loads of refurbs that are just 10 grand refurbs, and then they'd value up at 80. That's, you know, small figures. They're on like little 2 beds. Then the 3 beds, at that time, I would buy them for a similar 50, 60 grand, and they'd value up at 90, 95. They're now worth about 120, the 3 beds, and the 2 beds are worth 90, 95, some 100. So there has been growth, but it isn't an area of huge growth, but they cash flow well. You know, if I buy went and bought one today, they're cash flowing £300, £350. Interesting though, in the last few years, I have had a flurry of being able to pick up properties as cheap as what I used to buy them from auction.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I've bought some cracking properties. This last year, I've bought some absolute steals.
And are you starting to use your own money now, Christina, or are you still using angel investment?
I still use angel investment. I feel, I feel so often skint. And I think it's whilst you are continuing to grow a business fairly aggressively. When I say aggressively, if you're buying 5, 6, 7, 8 deals a year, and you are leaving cash in, you always need to use other people's money.
Yeah. And are you trying? Do you have like a target that you're trying to buy maybe 5 a year now? Or are you? What way do you? What's your kind of strategy now?
8 a year. So last year it was mainly flips. Which was really fun. And then this year it's a mix of I'd like to make 100 grand from flips, and I'd also like to increase my net monthly profit by 3 grand a month. So I've just found a block of flats. I've said I don't like planning. I have done planning a few times. In this particular one, I'm going to need to get planning for the top floor to turn that into a fourth flat, which already makes me feel full of anxiety. It really does. I feel so much resistance to it because it's never been a nice experience. But I'm trying to just be like, oh, just go with it, it's fine, it'll all be good. But I already feel stressed. But which is just being honest, isn't it? But so 3 of them are tenanted. It's already making about turning over about 22 grand a year. I got it for 135 from auction. And then with the top floor basically was used as a flat, but without planning, and now it just needs planning and rejigging around a little bit. But all everything's there, just needs to be new kitchen and stuff. So that will bring an income of 30,000 with a net profit of about 1,100 a month, and the done up value will be 210 on that.
Brilliant.
So. Yeah, so though I'm looking more at like title splits, but I will happily buy to let one after another if I can pick them up cheap enough and I can acquire them quickly. So I love buying from auction because it's quick. I can't remember the last time I bought one deal through an estate agent last year, and it dragged on and on and on. I'd much rather go, I've got funds, let's go to the auction, let's get it done, because you can complete in a few weeks, and it's that momentum. That's the momentum we like.
So you don't, so they teach you a lot. First of all, do you go training? Are you still training now? Do you still go networking? Do you still do the things that got you to where you are now, or have you changed your kind of your strategy? And what do you still go networking and training?
I've done all sorts over the last few. So I went through a phase of about a year and a half. I didn't really go to anything. I wasn't part of a network, wasn't part of a property network. And it was so interesting. In a way, I felt like I was getting a little bit sort of in my own bubble. I was going to like National Lord Association things. I did go to a few things, but I wasn't part of a network. But the one thing that I can tell you, actually, if I'm being honest, is I stayed in my lane, I focused, and I didn't wobble at all. And then now I'm part of the community, my head spins all the time. What everyone else is doing, I compare myself. And I always compare myself to the top 0.1%. I will compare myself with one superhuman that it manages to do 200 deals a year, and then I think, why can't I do that? And then I make unrealistic goals, and I start running a race that really isn't mine. So I think it's really useful, and I love learning, absolutely love learning. So in that respect, I love it. I love what's going on, you know, the thing that's going on in the economy. But I'm also conscious that sometimes it's not great for me to hear about lots of different strategies, because I end up looking at everything and doing nothing.
It's really interesting you should say that, because I'd be more disciplined when I go there, because I go over to the UK kind of. I used to go every month, and then I stopped, like yourself, for about a year to focus on what I was doing, and then I've actually started to bring myself back over there. And the main reason why I bring myself over there is the like that your head can be turned, and I do see a lot of people in the room, and they're listening to you, and they're like, "Oh, tell me this, tell me this." And they literally don't know where to go. And it's really interesting. You're after mentioning like staying in your lane a good few times. And I think that is 100% true. I think you do need to stay in your lane. But my head kept on being turned at the beginning. But now I'm very, very focused when I go over there. But what I go over there for now is the learnings. Like you've said, I love learning. It's the social media, it's the, it's getting ideas about the picking ideas. And I won't change my strategy. My strategy is my strategy. But what I like is I like learning from other people in terms of their strategy and how I can use that for my own strategy. So I think if you can go to those places and you are disciplined and you know where you're comfortable with what you're doing, I think that they can be a good place. But yeah, like that, there's definitely a few people in the room who I can see their head is turning and they're getting nowhere fast because of that. They're just running around looking, you know. You mentioned there, Christina, that like because other in these property training events they talk about direct to vendor marketing, and whereas it seems like maybe you're not doing so much direct to vendor and it's more you're using social media to try and raise your angel investment and then you're getting the properties via auction. Am I right in saying that, or do you use your social media to try and get your direct to vendor deals also?
I do direct to vendor, but not, I don't do it in a really conscious effort led way. So I will have deals that people bring to me via social media, which I bought. I also have a few contacts that will bring me stuff. I guess they're like sourcing agents, but they are very specific in the way that they operate, where it is an urgent completion, and they'll bring me something and they'll say this needs to complete in 2 weeks, and there's no messing and there's no searches, and you indemnify and you sold a scene. Sometimes you don't get to see it, it's videos. So I've done a fair few of those types of deals. I have agents occasionally bring me stuff. And then auction is probably, I'd say auction is my favorite. Really, because it's that balance between that stuff that I'm doing there is risky, and I would never recommend anyone to buy like that unless you really know your area and you are really confident investor with good builders that have done it numerous. Like it's not a strategy that I would recommend for someone to just jump into, really. So yeah, I kind of get deals from lots of different places, but yeah, direct to vendor is definitely not my
Like a
primary.
strategy.
Yeah, really. When I started, I did loads of leafleting, and I've bought a fair few properties direct to vendor over the years. The biggest change for me, if I'm being totally honest, is having kids. I don't like my phone ringing. It's true, and that is just the truth. That is the truth. I don't want people ringing me while I tell you, it's a weird thing, that, isn't it? But I just really respect my own, I don't know, my time with the kids. And yeah, I just don't want my phone ringing because a lot of the time they're nutters.
Very good. And it's great to see that you do, because I am a victim of that. Like where my phone could be ringing at like 8 o'clock at night as I'm putting the kids to bed, and I can be a victim of that, and sometimes my head is not with it, and I like, and you could tell it's not the right time, but yet you feel like you have to take it. So I can be a victim of that now. Christina, do you work now with do you like when you're onboarding an investor, an angel investor, they want to give you money. Do you tend now to work with a small few investors who just keep recycling the money? That being every time you refinance with the bank, you give them their money back and they just give it straight back to you? Or do you actively source new investors? Because from my point of view, I found I don't ever take on investors who give me 10 grand, 20 grand, 50 grand. I always take on investors, I think like yourself, that does the full purchase price of the house. And the reason being is that I just feel like it's one person to deal with versus many different people. You can give them full, more security than what you could do if they were just giving you 10 or 20 grand. And people who have that level of money to invest, they tend to know that they're investors. They're more not educated, but they're more educated in the investment world. So it's not their life savings. So they're not onto you the whole time. They trust you. So that's the reason why I like to take on like maybe one investor for a big sum of money and then just keep recycling the one investor's money rather than just trying to look for, you know, small amounts and do a volume based in that way. What way do you work? Do you like to have like one or two key investors, or do you also actively take on small amounts as well?
So I generally don't advertise for investors at all anymore. They come to me through recommendation, word of mouth. I've gone through cycles of all different variants of what you said there. I've had seasons of, oh, I just don't want any more smaller investors, and they can, you know, that kind of thing. And then more of a relaxed approach of, I've got some key bigger investors that will lend on the bigger stuff. So for example, Empress Hall was 400 grand and they want the bigger stuff. They don't want to lend on 50. They don't want to lend on 50 grand projects, not big enough for them. So I've got some sort of key players for the different size deals, but my stance has kind of changed in that. So it's got to be 30 minimum, really. 30 to 50 is kind of the minimum. But I have a lot of dancers from the West End that come to me. They're very trusting people. They are really chilled, generally. And I don't know, I feel like I want to help them, you know, I don't want to turn them away. So I'll use their funds for refurbs and, and actually all of my investors are mega chill. I don't get questioned or chased or nothing. Like, they just want their interests and then they go, can we do it again? I'll go, let me just have a look and I'll get back to you. And sometimes they need to wait a couple of months because I don't have anything. Sometimes I can just roll it straight into another refurb or whatever. So yeah, I kind of know what my investors need in terms of who would fund what kind of deal. So on the smaller projects, actually, my smaller investors work well for that because the bigger investors don't want the smaller deal. So it's kind of a balancing act. But if the only times really that I've sort of gone, no, I don't want to, I know it's not that I've said I don't want to work with you anymore, but the red flags for me is if it's a small amount of money and their communication isn't good and I'm trying to pay them back and they don't reply to me for a week and a half or 2 weeks. And then, you know, and I say, here's your funds. Have you thought what you'd like to do? And then it's another few weeks before I hear from them. So I was like, oh, it's not worth the effort, you know, and then I can't be bothered with that. So I just won't, you know, let them reinvest with me. I'll just say it's been fantastic. I don't need your funds right now, you know. But if they're, you know, they've got good communication and they send me the documents that I need and it's all quite easy, then I'll happily work with people.
Yeah, good. And some, I'm sure you've got some funny stories. You've got a lot of properties there, Christina. Have you ever thought about, oh my God, this is just too hard. I'm just going to leave it all. It's just easier being a singer. And I just want to get out of this property world. I think I've had that kind of thing about maybe five or six times in the last 5 years. Where I just want to, it's too much hard work and I just want to get out of it. What kind of horror stories have you got? And actually, something that we didn't touch on is the buy-to-lets. Haven't your rules changed over there, Christina, or your regulations where there's going to be more rules and regulations in relation to buy-to-let? Do you see that as a risk going forward? Are you going to change your strategy at all because of it?
I mean, it all creates low level anxiety. But I think what I'm observing is a lot of landlords selling.
Okay.
Yeah. To be honest with you, I think if you're a responsible landlord and you're a good landlord and you don't mind maintaining your properties and keeping them in good working order, a lot of the stuff We're doing anyway. The only the thing that I see with the Renters' Rights Act that is not fair is that tenants can get themselves into basically 4 months worth of arrears before we can do anything. And
Right.
the court system does not work. So it's kind of like the government are just trying to do anything to, it's like the landlords are being totally ignored, and we're not, the facts are that the court system does not work. And Ben Beadle, who's the CEO of the National Landlord Association, is saying, what are you going to do about this? Because if you can't serve a Section 21 and everything has to be a court notice, how does this work when you've already got tenants then in 4 months worth of arrears? And then we start, and they just don't seem to care. And I think that's, I just think a lot of people that only have a couple of properties will leave because it just won't be worth it for them. I think that there'll be a lot of opportunity. I think there will be some pain along the way. I think there will be, if you get caught in that, I think it'll be painful. But there will be an upside of if you have enough properties, you'll be able to get through it. And I think the opportunity will outweigh the pain of getting caught maybe once or twice with some tenants that aren't paying. I also think though that it just means that people are gonna, landlords are just gonna be so strict with the vetting. I don't know who's gonna house people that anyone that has any form of bad credit. I don't know who's going to house them. Maybe the council will just have to house them because no landlord is going to take that risk unless they have no idea about the changes.
I come in. So in Ireland we have those rules with buckets and spades added to them. There's new tenants have lo loads of rights over here. And the court system, which is called the RTB over here, they can be in arrears, and by the time you bring them to court, it can be up to 18 months without being paid over here. And because we got this acute housing shortage, there's like a, do you know, like a citizens' advice bureau that's set up for tenants over here, and it's called Threshold. And the advice that they're giving, which is a government agency body, the advice that they're giving to the tenants is to overhold on the property, i.e., if you've got nowhere to go, just stay there. Don't, you know,
Yeah, they could
I don't
be
know that saying not paying is,
cancelled.
it's just really silly. So there's new rules being brought out, coming out in March this year, actually next month, where what they're trying to do is they also set like a rent cap for the last 6 years, I think it was. So you couldn't increase your rent. So once you got a tenant in and they were in at the, say, 600-700 euro a month, you could only increase it by 2% a year. So even if the rents, the market rents had jumped to like 2,000 euro, you could still only do your 2% based on your original 600 euro. So what they did was, in March, they brought in this new rule to say that any new tenants going into your house, you can now reset to the new market rent, which is your 2 grand a month, say, for example. And so that's fine. So we're giving that to the landlord, but then on the other hand, then they're saying, but the tenants, we're going to give you even more rights now because of this new rule that we're bringing in. And that means that you can stay in that property for 6 years without ever being evicted. So that means that if the landlord ever wants to sell their house in that 6 years, they have to sell with tenant in situ. And over here, because the rules are so in favor of the tenants, no sane investor will ever buy a property with a tenant in situ over here. So basically, they've just kind of said, like, you know, you've just got to give up control for 6 years for your house. And at the end of the 6 years, then God knows how you're going to get the tenant out if needs be. So they're trying to solve a housing crisis by saying, look, they know landlords are leaving the market. So that was the reason why they brought in this new, you can reset the market rent. But then equally, then they put more rules in favor of the tenants. So in my mind, what they've done is they've just over regulated, and landlords are just leaving the market now. So we do have some good deals coming on the market at the moment, because landlords are leaving. So with that comes a like massive threat, but massive opportunity for somebody who's a full-time property investor. There is opportunity there, because what they've done is the government have actually restricted supply even more. And they will continue to do so. So by restricting supply, it automatically kind of brings up, like naturally brings up the rents, and it brings up the value of your property as well. But it's just navigating that. It's like that low level anxiety that you mentioned. It's like, you know, can you weather the storm? And the people who are in this as a business or as a profession, they probably can weather the storm and they can see ways out of it. But people with 1, 2, 3 houses, like in my mind, my advice to anyone with 1, 2, 3 houses in Ireland, I would say get out, because it's not a market that it's not a free market. It's not a market that you should be in, because it's just so over-regulated, you know.
And the thing is, though, there's so much negativity that the way that landlords are pursued and the way that we're portrayed is with such negativity. We're being used as a political weapon to stir up. You know, we're just being used as something that, let's just get the landlords, and not realizing that we're like the plaster that's holding it all together, because the council don't have enough houses. So should be actually saying thank you so much. Social housing that the council own, it is mostly shocking, actually. And the best quality properties on the market are generally owned by private landlords, yet we are being absolutely destroyed in the tabloids. It is interesting. It is interesting to imagine where we will be in 5 years' time, what it looks like, how much stock there is, what it's done to property values, what it's done to property rents. I'm kind of like that with it. Oh, I want to see.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I just feel fortunate that I have grown a big portfolio, but then equally kind of scared for myself. There is word of, obviously big corporates, big banks, big pension funds buying portfolios, and an opportunity to that they potentially will buy whole portfolios for good money. That could be an opportunity, but it's all if, when, you know, all what ifs and all. I don't want to have to hand my portfolio over, if I'm perfectly honest. I don't want to have to sell my portfolio. I want to be able to keep it till I'm old and give it to my kids. So all of it makes me feel really uncomfortable that we are feeling pressure.
Yeah, to do that. Well, you should be really proud of yourself, and the fact that you've built up such a big portfolio, and you know, you're creating a legacy for your kids. You're actually creating a bit of stability there for the kids. You know, they don't have to, you know, in my mind, I'm like, the kids can go off and get a job and they can learn, and I want them to learn. But at the end of the day, I know deep down that I will have that portfolio for them to have that, because you never know what it's going to look like in the future, you know. And I think property is a good way of doing it. So, Christina, I thank you for coming on to the Solid Foundations Property Podcast. It's been an amazing chat with you. And it's great to see other women in the industry doing it, because there's not too many of us that are kind of smashing it. Like, you know, well done, Christina. This is really, really good to hear and really inspiring to hear. And I think from what I understand from you, and the message I'm getting from you, and is that you're really honest. And I love that. I love the honesty of it. Like, it's not all roses, you know. It can be tough going, but you show the good with the bad. And I think that's the reason why people would trust you to put their money with you, because I'd rather hear about the bad stuff as well, you know. So I really appreciate you coming onto the Solid Foundations Property Podcast, and I hope that
the Solid Foundations Property Podcast is brought to you in association with Gap Property Investments, helping you getting a better return on your money in 2026 through property. Check out gappropertyinvestments.com, and also Cities Days, Ireland's leading provider of customized accommodation solutions, specifically designed for contractor teams working on projects. Check out citystays.ie.